The next case is, 00-1085, Derek Funk versus Rent All Mart, Inc. Mr. Davis.
May it please the court, I'm Tom Davis. I'm here on behalf of, in this case, the respondents, actually the defendants, Rent All Mart and Bob Torbit. In an unusual position in that counsel for the petition won't be arguing today. I told John before we started, I reserved 5 minutes to rebut myself, given the circumstances. Basically what this is a Rule 18 certification case. And the issue in the case is what is the statute of limitations now for common law intentional tort licensure type actions. The federal court up in Toledo certified this question after Jim Jeffrey, who is personal counsel for Rent All Mart, filed a motion to dismiss on this point. The actual background of the case is Mr. Fish's client, Derek Funk, was an employee of Rent All Mart, and there was an incident over in Lima where scissor lift tipped, and in the process of riding, etc., the scissor lift fell and injured him. And so you have here an intentional tort claim brought against the employer, we know that this is kind of the third go-round that we have on these types of causes of action. The statute of limitations issue comes about because originally when the legislator jumped into the arena, the enactment was 41-21-80, and within that one statute, there was a one-year time limit. The court found that unconstitutional in 1991 in the Brady case, and then came round two. Round two is 27-45-01, and that was enacted in 1995. This time, though, separate from the actual cause of action type statute, the legislature put in a one-year statute of limitations in the part of the code where the rest of the statutes of limitations generally are, and it's a one-year statute. Of course, we know that in the Johnson v. P. case, the second go-round, 27-45-01, was also found unconstitutional. And since then, in essence, the one-year statute has sort of been dangling there because it was not specifically challenged. Routinely, there wouldn't be any constitutionality problems with that kind of time limit. So it's been there, and this court last August accepted the certified question of whether or not it would apply to what would now be a common law case, but if not, whether or not some other statute of limitations would be applied. Now, the unique thing about 27-45-01 and the bill that enacted it, as well as this one-year statute of limitations, is the fact that as the legislature has been doing back and forth when we have these challenging legal questions, it's been putting in additional language in the bill indicating what its intent is. And in this case, they put in language indicating the intent was that any part of the statutes challenged and found unconstitutional or invalid at a later point should be severed, and the rest of the statute not in effect or not challenged should remain. So you have that language. The other thing that they put in the bottom of the bill was some superseding language which listed a variety of cases where the court found problems with the intentional tort cause of action in the statute, and those cases were superseded. One of those was a case called Hunter versus Shenango, Hunter versus Shenango was a case that came about, if I remember correctly, I think it was in the gap when 4121 may not have been in effect. I'm not quite sure of the timing of it, but I know the rule was, the court said that the two-year bodily injury statute of limitations applied to common law intentional tort actions at that time. But in the bill, the legislature said that the intent of the enactment, which reenacted a one-year statute, the one we're talking about here today, 112, was that that should be superseded. Our position is that in construing the statute, the court should recognize that twice the legislature has indicated that it is its intent that intentional tort actions be subject to a one-year time limit, and has also specifically indicated that it shouldn't be subject to a two-year time limit. So the first key principle that we believe is applicable here is clearly the issue as indicated by the legislature that 1 year should be the limit.
And exactly how is that indicated by the legislature?
In the language of the bill that enacted 274501 and 2305112, they indicated that those statutes were enacted as part of their intention to supersede Hunter versus Shenango, which was the case that found that two-year statute should apply. So,
do you have your brief there in front of you, just as a matter of clarification, because I want to be sure I'm not confusing these two cases.
Yes, Your
Honor. On page 3, sir, the last full paragraph, should the third sentence be Johnson rather than Brady? No problem. As long as I understand, you're not talking about the Brady case with regard to...
That would be incorrect.
Unkitch. Okay.
Yeah, because 4180, the 1 year was in there. So, yes, that's absolutely correct. I'm a little disappointed in myself for not catching that. The difficulty that is presented with the situation we have with 2745.01 and the one-year statute is that 0.112 indicates that an employment intentional tort action brought under 274501 should be subject to a one-year time limit. And the problem, of course, is that 274501 is no longer there. The best way that I can argue this to you in terms of keeping that statute applicable, in addition to the legislative intent argument that I discussed, is to indicate to you that many times in the past, this court and the appellate courts of this state have been confronted with situations where there are causes of action that may not precisely match a statute of limitations, but yet the court has to look and determine which one it is going to find applicable. And that's kind of understandable because many times it is the courts that create causes of action. The statutes of limitations, most of them have been sitting there for years and years. And so you end up with a situation where the court has to determine what it's going to plug in regard to this new cause of action.
In that regard, and looking at overall, I guess you would look at some sense of public policy considerations, and you could add that fact. Statute of limitations for fraud, for example, is longer than it is for a tort, right?
For your,
and what do you suppose that would be?
I wish I knew exactly.
Well, what might it be that it, because fraud involves some really ugly intent.
Well, that could be true, but it would be hard to analogize when you also have the specific intentional tort type battery, et cetera, which is also pretty ugly. Now, the only other reason I could think of is perhaps they give a longer statute of limitations for fraud because of the nature of it being a deceitful kind of act.
Hardware to discover.
Yes. Whereas battery, the intentional tort kind of thing is overt, most likely, and therefore, perhaps, the shorter time limit ought to apply for reasons of the fact that let's get the evidence in, let's get this case going, and let's resolve it.
Now, another guiding principle, I would assume, if it's unclear as to where it fits, would be to try and put it in the box that might make the most common sense so that practitioners wouldn't make mistakes. Wouldn't that be a good guiding principle? Because citizens aren't walking around thinking, gee, on a contract in writing, I've got like 15 years.
Yeah.
And not in writing, you know, citizens really aren't walking around with that in front of their mind. Their lawyers are.
Yes.
And so, wouldn't a sensible scheme about something that would help lawyers generally not make tragic mistakes for their clients by belonging to this statute?
Obviously, no one would want to see another lawyer blow a statute, but the circumstance that you have with the statute of limitations is it's always hard on somebody. And I don't think I've seen a reported case that I know of where the court has construed the statute of limitations where the plaintiff is always
so safe. So what's the hardship to someone who commits an intentional tort in the workplace by having a 2-year rather than a 1-year statute?
The hardship, I think, in terms of the situation we've got here is a little bit what I explained earlier about the fact that the nature of these allegations are such that it is a potentially disruptive type of claim. It is one that runs through the workplace. I've lived many of these as a trial lawyer and seen the non-lawsuit related ramifications that they have. And so the hardship that there is to these kinds of situations is the fact that they're disruptive. The sooner they're brought, most likely, hopefully, the sooner they're final. The other aspect of it in terms of it's related to that disruptive aspect is the insurance nature. I'm not sure if the court is aware of what is going on in the insurance market with these kinds of claims.
Can you even insure it?
Well, you have the cases that go back to talk about stopgap policies, and I know the court has been discussed those a couple of times, but stopgap language or policies of length, those aren't being issued anymore. So the point of the 1-year statute, at least it's a peace of mind thing for the employer in terms of knowing that maybe they've had a bad accident that their workers' compensation premiums are paying for, but after 1 year they have a right to assume that the doggone thing is over and they don't have to worry about the heightened aspect of the case and the problems that you have with the evidence on such a very, very serious claim. The worry is over. And I can tell you personally on this case, this was a worrisome one for my client. I've been over there. I've talked to people. I talked to Mr. Torbett, and when I went over there for a meeting, the two owners of the business showed up because they were concerned. So the 1-year statute in that aspect does have some clear ramifications in my view. Now the final point that is also weaved into this, and I think it's pretty well explained in the brief, and there's lots of decisions on this, is the specific over general. Where there's an earlier enactment, and it's the more specific one, then that is the one that generally the court applies. So you have a situation here where this clearly is a more specific statute, and for that reason, it is the one that we suggest should apply here. That goes back down to the Adriano's case. The first case I did as a law clerk was an issue on the Adriano's case. I had to tell Ted Earl what statute of limitations I thought applied. And we'd argue that that rule, there's numerous of those cases where the court applies that rule, both in statute of limitations and non-statute of limitations aspects, has found that to be controlling. And in this case, that plugs the one-year statute in. So unless there's any other questions, I'd ask the court to consider the matter and advise the federal court and the parties what their views are on what statute of limitations applies in this challenging area. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.